Turn tonight, please, to Judges chapter number 7. Judges chapter number 7. And let's pray tonight, and then we'll kind of work through our way through the passage, rather divided by the topic that it deals with. Father, thank you again for creating us, and thank you for talking to us, and thank you for loving us. Thank you for assuring us, of reminding us again and again of who you are and what you can do, of putting it on display in the Bible and in the world around us. Father, may we always remember that these stories we read in Old Testament were real people, that they were written for our instruction, for our education, sometimes for our admonition, that we would never be presumptuous about the practice of our own Christianity. And so please help us to take your words to our very hearts and to live and obey them. And pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. So Judges 6, 7, 8, really into 9, continue the story of the life of Gideon. Gideon is really in many ways probably the pivotal character in the book of Judges. Samson is perhaps a little more colorful, but Gideon is a lot more complex, I think. And he, in many ways, represents as much as, if not more than, any of the judges. He reflects the age in which he lived. And by that, I don't mean the culture in which he lived. I mean the spiritual age in which he lived. He is a much conflicted man, and some of that will begin to emerge this evening. We will lead up into that. So, of course, God appeared to him. We have the cycle of conduct, the sinfulness of Israel, the response of God to enslave the people, their cry to the Lord and his deliverance. And we've seen that, and God raises up this young man, or this man, Gideon, and then whittles down his army to 300 soldiers. Not that he needed 300 soldiers, but 300 soldiers was enough to demonstrate to everybody that the victory would be the Lord's. And it is in that, in continuing that, and the conclusion to that, that we will undertake our passage this evening. And I would remind us again that the story of Gideon is the story of three conflicts. He goes to war against Baal and the altar of Baal, that's chapter 6. He goes to war against Midian, that's chapter 7. And much of chapter 8, he is occupied with fighting his own countrymen. And that really functions as kind of the mirror to chapter 7. Last Wednesday night, we talked about the fact that God used Gideon's weakness to magnify his own divine strength, and that's an excellent aspect of human weakness. Paul said, "When I am weak, then am I made strong." In the end of chapter 7 and into chapter 8, we see a different type of weakness, and this is not a good weakness. This is a very unfortunate kind of weakness, and confident that I can make the point several ways, and hopeful that I can make it in a couple of other ways. So so we're going to begin reading in verse number 23 of chapter 7. God has given Gideon this great victory. To this point, the Israelites have really yet to use their weapons. They have a sword or a flashlight. We would say a flashlight or a lantern in one hand, a trumpet or a bugle in the other. And they have shouted out to the Lord, and the Lord has given a great victory. And the Midianites basically have gone to war against themselves. In their panic, they have been swinging the sword at each other. And this created this pandemonium, and the people then begin to do what people in a panic do. They begin to run and to scatter. So the first section that we are introduced to here actually begins in verse number 23 and runs into chapter 8 and verse number 3. And this is the conflict with Ephraim. So the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali and out of Asher and out of all Manasseh and pursued after the Midianites. And Gideon sent messengers throughout all Mount Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites, take before them the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan." Then all the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together and took the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan. And they took two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb, and they slew Oreb upon the rock Oreb, and Zeb they slew at the winepress of Zeb, and pursued Midian, and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side of Jordan. And the men of Ephraim said unto him, "Why hast thou served us thus, that thou callest us not when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites?" And they did chide with him sharply. And he said unto them, "What have I done now in comparison of you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God hath delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison of you?" Then their anger was abated toward him when he had said that. So, as I mentioned, chapter 8 chronicles Gideon's conflict with his own people, and here is the first element of it. We have this panic in the Midianite camp, and the Midianites are identified. There's Midianites, there's Amalekites, and there is, according to chapter 7, the men of the east, or the army of the east. And so these are people who are going to be across the Jordan River, on the east side of the Jordan. So as word of the battle gets out, and word of the victory gets out, and word of the pandemonium gets out, men from Naphtali and Asher and Manasseh enter the fray. Now, we are in the northern part of Israel. Oops, excuse me. This is the northern part of Israel. The farther northernmost tribe is going to be Gad. These people are up towards the north. And then Gideon sends messengers off to Ephraim. And Ephraim is really going to be very close to the actual battlefield itself. And it's going to be in the northern part of the country, but at the southernmost part of the northern part of the country. And Gideon calls upon them to deal with the flight of the Midianites back towards their home, back towards the east. This is what we're reading here, and it talks about the water of Jordan and Bethbara, the waters that are across there. And this is what they do. They rise up to this fight, and they enter into the fray, and they capture two of the Midianite princes, two of the leading soldiers of the nation, and they execute them. And they execute them, obviously, according to verse number 25, on very personal ground, like in their backyard. Oreb upon the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they slew at the winepress of Zeb, places of great significance to these men. What happens next is what is most unfortunate. They are very angry at Gideon. And that's what's being addressed there in verse number 1 of chapter 8. Why hast thou served us? Why have you treated us like this? Why did you wait till this point in the battle to call us? Why weren't we here at the beginning? Why didn't we get to be in the first part of the battle? And as you're thinking through that, folks, let's just remember exactly how it is that God gathered this army. God gathered this army by whittling it down. He wasn't looking for a big army. He was looking for a little army. He wasn't putting human strength on display. He was putting divine strength on display. And they did chide with him sharply. Gideon, on the other hand, and much to his credit, in verses 2 and 3, is very diplomatic and very gracious to them. And he is working hard to appease the wrath of the Ephraimites. And he just points out to them that he is insignificant even relative to them. and that nothing he has done compares with anything that they have done. And the Ephraimites in chapter 12, early in particular, the Ephraimites seem to be a tribe that wants this kind of limelight or this kind of glamour. But here's the point, folks, right? Chapter 7 unfolds for us the beauty of human weakness in the presence of the Lord and the way the Lord can use human weakness for his own glory to accomplish a great victory. This is a different form of weakness. This is the weakness that is the result of internal strife and conflict. Most specifically, this is the result of pride. These people are proud. They are upset that they have not been given greater honor. And so here's one of the instances. Here's a cause of weakness, right? So we as an assembly, we as a local church, we can say, God is strong, we are not. We are weak, God is strong, we need God's help, and that honors the Lord. That's one form of weakness. We can fight with each other, and we can strive with each other, we can contend with each other. And I would just point out to you that the Bible warns us about this in many places. Here's just a couple. In Galatians chapter 5, we're told that this kind of conduct is the work of the flesh, never the work of the Spirit. Idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies. These kinds of internal conflicts, the things that characterized the church at Corinth, where people were trying to get to have a little more status than the next guy and a little more glory, and heresy, which genuinely refers to people gathering, right, to these kind of divisions or sects where you gather followers and your gang is bigger than the next guy's gang. Paul tells us in Philippians 2:3, let nothing be done through strife or vain glory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves. So in this instance, Gideon comes off very well. Ephraim comes off very poorly. But here's a form of weakness, folks, that God is very much opposed to, but it is very easy for it to creep in, this kind of wounded feeling that we have not been recognized properly, that we have not been given our due, that we have not been magnified highly enough in the eyes of others. So there's one of the conflicts and one of the elements of weaknesses. That brings us back to Judges chapter 8 and verses 4 through 9. And here is a further conflict with Israel. Excuse me. A conflict with two villages. I wouldn't imagine that they're very large, but two villages. Verse number 4, Gideon came to Jordan and passed over. So he's come to the river and he's passed over. He is moving from the west to the east, just like if we got in our cars and went across the bridge and crossed over into Council Bluffs from west to east. We had crossed the Missouri. Gideon came to Jordan, passed over. He and the 300 men that were with him faint, yet pursuing them. And he said unto the men of Succoth, give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. And the princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thine army? And Gideon said, therefore, when the Lord hath delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into mine hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. And he went up thence to Penuel, and he spake unto them likewise. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. And he spake also unto the men of Penuel, saying, when I am come again in peace, I will break down this tower. I'm going to stop there because the story will resume, but there's a bit of an interlude in verses 10 through 12. So if you can just imagine, folks, and again, I just mention it only because it's the way the geography rolls out. Sometimes I give these stories, use these illustrations, and people think I hate Iowa, and I assure you that I don't. But the battle is moving from the west, where we are in Omaha, to the east, where Council Bluffs is. And Gideon and his men are in pursuit of the army. We will learn in a little bit, there are still 15,000 soldiers organized into kind of a cohesive army, and Gideon and his 300 are in pursuit of them. And when they cross over, the first place that they come to is this village or city of Succoth. And Gideon says, will you feed us? Now remember, once again, folks, that Gideon is heading to the east because the Midianites are heading to the east, and the Midianites are heading to the east because east is home. They're headed back home. And so the men of Succoth say, actually, it's kind of gruesome. If you look very carefully at verse number 6, the princes of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand?" And literally the word there is palms. In other words, do you have some physical evidence that you have dealt with these men? Specifically, if you chop their hands off, can you show me their hands? And we will know that we are safe from this threat. And Gideon said, no, they're still running. And so their response is really very pragmatic. Why should we give, if you haven't killed the kings, why should we give you bread? You can see what they're thinking, folks. If you haven't dealt with the army, and the army is heading this way, and they find out that we've helped you, then we're going to be in great trouble. And so Gideon threatens them in verse number 7. And there is, by the way, right, just so that we're clear on this, there is Jewish land on the other side of the Jordan. This goes back into the book of Numbers and the book of Deuteronomy and the people that are on the other side there. So Gideon keeps going, and he comes to the place called Penuel in verse number 8. Penuel is the place where in Genesis 32, I think, Jacob wrestled with the angel of the Lord. That was the place as he was working his way just outside of the promised land. Just before he enters the promised land, he has the all-night wrestling match with the Lord. Gideon again poses the same question, "Will you feed us?" Gideon again gets the same response. Gideon again issues similar threats. So, the first conflict is a conflict that is caused by pride. The second conflict is a conflict that is caused by fear. And once again, folks, the New Testament cautions us about being controlled by fear. We are to be controlled by fear if it is the fear of the Lord that is controlling us. We are not to be controlled by the fear of men. That is the biblical norm and the expectation. And somehow, these guys were completely impervious to the great victory that God was winning with 300 soldiers without a shot being fired in anger, so to speak. Which raises the question, right? Should fear be a legitimate deciding factor in our Christian service? Is physical safety always the most important consideration? And I would add, it seems to me that the fear here is being driven particularly by unbelief, which I suppose it always is, that these men are not paying attention to the fact that Gideon is there chasing after Midianites because God has given a great victory. So there is conflict number 2. In between that, although it's really a part of the same story, right? Because to this point, the refusal to help has been based upon the fact that you haven't captured the kings. And if you had the kings, maybe that would be a different story. And so in verses 10 through 12, he captures the kings. Verse number 10, "Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their hosts with them about 15,000 men." So they got an army of 15,000 soldiers. "All that were left of the host of the children of the east. For there fell 120,000 men that drew sword." So 135,000 went to battle. 15,000 remain. Those are catastrophic casualty, folks. Those are catastrophic casualties. Our military guys could speak more intelligently than I could about this, but if I remember correctly, in the early days of the air war in World War II, U.S. casualties were about 10%, and those were considered unacceptable, catastrophic losses. This is what? 90%? 90% of the army? So, Verse number 11, Gideon went up by the way of them that dwelt in tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbeha, and smote the host, for the host was secure. They had finally found a place where they could fortify themselves, and Gideon goes after them. And now we're having evidently what appears to be a conventional type battle, and perhaps other soldiers have joined him. We're not told. Verse number 12, when Zebah and Zalmunna fled, he pursued after them and took the two kings of Midian, Zebah and Zalmunna, and discomfited all the host. So he fights against the remaining 15,000, captures the two kings, sends the remaining soldiers into a panic, and the conflict with Midian at this point comes to an end. That brings us to the next section, verses 13 through 17, in which Gideon now retaliates against Succoth and Penuel. So there's the conflict with Ephraim related to pride. There's conflict with Succoth and Penuel related to fear. Those two are very easy to argue. I mean, if you get enough commentaries, you're going to find people who are commending the men for refusing to help, but it just doesn't seem to have much going for it. Beginning in verse number 13, things get a little more cloudy. So, verses 13 through 17, Gideon the son of Joash returned from battle before the sun was up, and caught a young man of the men of Succoth, and inquired of him, and he described unto him the princes of Succoth and the elders thereof, even 70 men. And he came unto the men of Succoth, and said, Behold Zebah and Zalmunna, with whom ye did upbraid me, saying, Are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thy men that are weary? And he took the elders of the city, and the thorns of the wilderness, and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. And he beat down the tower of Penuel and slew the men of the city. So early in the morning, he captures this young man who lives in Succoth. What he was doing, where he was going, is completely untold to us. In verse number 14, you are told that he described unto him the princes of Succoth. And I just need to pause here. We just need to talk about that. He wasn't giving a physical description. The word described actually means like transcribed or scribed. What he did was he wrote down 77 names. So he wasn't describing the men. There's one guy, he's tall, and he's got a full head of hair and a beard and dark brown, you know, brown complexion, brown eyes, which everybody does. And then there's another guy, he's got dark complexion and brown eyes and, you know, a dark beard, but he's not as tall. I mean, it's not that kind of stuff. He wrote down these names. And so Gideon had those names. And with those names, he goes to these leaders and he begins then his retribution. Verse 16, he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. Again, that's what he asked. What do you mean he taught them? And that's just the idea of he disciplined, he spanked them, he beat them. Just like they did put a crown of thorns on Jesus' head, Gideon took these thorns and briars and he attacked these leaders with them. And then he went in verse number 17, he tore down the tower of Penuel and he slew the men of the city. And at this point, it gets a little more questionable. Is this a legitimate action or is this an illegitimate action? Should he have done it? Was he wrong in doing it? And you can find, folks, again, if you look online or look at the books and read the commentaries, you can find people who argue in either for either position. I'm going to take the position that this is a further dimension of the wrong kind of weakness. We've seen the weakness of pride and the conflict that results. We've seen the weakness of fear and the conflict that it results. And here we see the conflict of vengeance Gideon seems to take this incredibly personally. And the reason, just so, right, because the text doesn't say this was clearly wrong or hip hip hooray for Gideon for keeping his word. But I would point out to you that if you go back and read about Gideon and his own fears in chapter 6, and God's response to Gideon and his own fears in chapter 6, that there is a great inconsistency between the way God responded to Gideon in his doubts and apprehensions and the way Gideon responded to the men of Succoth and Peniel and theirs. So you can carry that over into the New Testament, right? Because we have a man who is forgiven much and a man who is forgiven little, and the man who is forgiven, right? We have the debtors, and we have this parable of the debtors, and the one who owes a little, and the one who owes much, and the one who owes much is forgiven, and the one who owes little is not. The man's going to extract it all from him, and the Lord points out what an inconsistency that is. And I would suggest that that is the way we should interpret this story. When we back up and interpret it in the entire light of the Bible, what we have is a man who is acting out of vengeful anger. And again, I would point out that this would be a great source of weakness in any assembly if we at Westwood Heights decided to retaliate against each other in any kind of a way, that it would be a grievous thing, it would be a sinful thing. Dearly beloved, Romans 12:19, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. It would be completely different, folks, if we had a clear indicator in the text that God said, now look, those guys need to be dealt with. Those guys need to be dealt with. But it wasn't, and again, so it just seems to me that this is further evidence of the weakness that we find, right? Gideon is fighting against Baal. He's fighting against Midian. He's fighting against Israel. And unfortunately, his own conduct is going to come to impose a problem. And that brings us to the last section that we'll deal with tonight, verses 18 through 21, which is, what do we do with these Midianite kings? They have been captured, and now they will be executed. And verses 18 through 21 pose one of the most perplexing passages in the Old Testament. Just does. So, not trying to make that a cop-out, but we read it and we just go, what? What do we do with this? So anyway, let's read it, and we'll ask the question, what do we do with it? Then said he unto Zeba and Zalmunna, what manner of men were they whom ye slew at Tabor? And they answered, as thou art, so were they. Each one resembled the children of a king. And he said, they were my brethren, even the sons of my mother. As the Lord liveth, if ye had saved them alive, I would not slay you. And he said unto Jether, his firstborn, up and slay them. But the youth drew not his sword, for he feared, because he was yet a youth. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, rise thou and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength. And Gideon arose and slew Zeba and Zalmunna, and took away the ornaments that were on their camels' necks. And we're going to stop there, because the story really changes direction after that. Gideon asks about these men that were slain at Tabor. Tabor is not mentioned in this account, but it is mentioned in Judges 4 and Judges 5 with Deborah and Barak. And it is evident from the context, folks, that Gideon is referring not to this military battle, but to some separated, isolated incident, some deliberate act, apparently of homicide. And this is something that had occurred in the historical past, because when you read through the account of the conflict in Judges 7, there are no Israeli casualties. No soldiers die. Nobody is injured. The Midianites are killing themselves, and there's just no record of Israeli casualties. But evidently something had happened in that period of time when the Midianites were severely oppressing the Jews, that these men were killed. And Gideon's question is simply this. I mean, he says, what manner of men were they whom ye slew? And that's really kind of the Hebrew equivalent of us asking, what was going on with those guys? What was the deal with those men? And part of the confusion is their reply, as thou art, so were they, each one resembled the children of a king. Which is kind of a oblique reference to Gideon's physique, that there was something about his demeanor and bearing that was very regal. Gideon's response is, verse number 19, they were my brethren, even the sons of my mother. So Gideon identifies them as his physical brothers. And here's part of the confusion and the complexity, at least to me. This doesn't fit at all with the way Gideon describes himself in Judges 6:15. My family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. So here's part of the issue. I mean, the event was real. Is Gideon identifying with them as kindred, you know, like we would call, like soldiers would call each other comrade or brother? In that sense, or is he talking to the fact that they were really physically his brothers? Then Gideon says, and I don't want to make too much of this, but Gideon says in verse number 19, as the Lord liveth, if he had saved them alive, I would not slay you. I do want to point out, folks, that if Gideon meant what he said there, that would have been sin. Whatever is going on in this account, whatever the story is, we can go back into the book of Numbers, and God is very clear that the Midianites must go. That the Midianites were to be killed, they were to be harassed, they were to be sought out, they were to be pursued. This was the Lord's instruction to the Jews. You have to get rid of the Midianites. They are dangerous people. So if Gideon had embraced the posture that I would let you live, I think he would have found himself in trouble with the Lord. So what is the event that happened? We don't know. What is the relationship of these men? We don't know. And then in verse number 20, he instructs his oldest son, who is still a young man, how old we do not know, to kill them. And again, we ask ourselves, why this instruction? Is this because Jether needs this kind of experience? You live in a violent world, and you're going to have to learn about this one of these days, and these are the kind of things that soldiers do, and so here's going to be your first time to do this. Or, as some people think, because this would have been very humiliating for a king to be killed by a child. And if we would not think that way, certainly we have to understand, folks, that the Bible reflects a Middle Eastern antiquity mindset about that kind of thing, that warrior soldiers found it greatly offensive to be beaten or defeated by an inferior. So... right, so it's totally consistent with that, right? You go kill them, serves them right, let the kid do it. But the young man refuses to do it because he is a child and because he is afraid, even with Ziba and Zalmunna's encouragement, and so Gideon rises up and does it in his own right. Now again, folks, there should be no question in our mind about the morality of the execution. God had clearly spoken these people needed to die. But we've had conflict of pride, conflict of fear, conflict of vengeance. And I would suggest to you, I wouldn't die on this hill, but I think if you would, as we read further, it will become more evident that there is a hint here. There is a hint of lust and greed. And that's just from the final comment that is made in verse number 21. He took away the ornaments that were on their camels' necks. He took away the crescent moons that were on their camels' necks. The religious identification, right? This is to this day the emblem of Islam. Now, these men are not Muslim, but they are Ishmaelites. And Gideon takes those trinkets for whatever reason that he wants those trinkets. And the significance, folks, is not so much necessarily in the trinket themselves. The significance is that of all that God could tell us about this event, that's the thing that he says. That's the thing that he points out. And then again, and I will admit that I am using that to help to be explained by what follows when it becomes clear that he wants the earrings, that he wants the jewels, he wants the riches. So I would just suggest to you that the passage concludes, right? And I've already said Gideon functions really in a very central, pivotal role in the book of Judges. He is a reflection of the spirit of the age, right? The spirit of the age is periods of great deliverance and periods of absolute and utter indifference, periods of spiritual highs and periods of great spiritual lows, this up and down. And Gideon seems to be a man who straddles both of those worlds. But in any event, folks, these are things that are certainly detrimental to the people of God: pride, fear, vengeance, greed. Those things are always dangerous to us, detrimental to us in our own spiritual life. All right, I'm going to stop there. Is there anything that you need to